evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Hitler's Table Talk. For those who are students of this study, it's October 23rd, 2014, which is my nephew's birthday, and this is episode 33. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and here is your other host coming right on.
All right. Hi there.
Ray Goodwin. Hi, Ray. All right, well, I just thought I'd mention the weather a little bit. Are you enjoying such nice weather as
Absolutely.
We're having here?
It was very nice down here, and a good day for golfing. It was cooler,
right.
And not much breeze blowing, so it was a very nice day here.
Okay, well, that's great. So now we're ready to go. I'm not sure about the dates after the first three or four sections. I'm going to be asking you what they are.
Okay.
But we are starting here on the 6th, right?
Yes.
Oh, I have a timeline. I have a timeline for April 6th. It's not anything earth-shattering, but Japanese naval forces put troops ashore on Manus Island in the Bismarck Archipelago, and it says that some sources give a date of 8th April for these landings. But they've got it on the 6th.
6th April, 1942, midday. German representatives abroad. Necessity of changing our methods. Follow the example of Britain. Honorary distinctions. The Wilhelmstrasse is certainly not happy in its choice of consuls. They're almost always honorary consuls entrusted with the defense of German interests abroad. Men who wangled an honorific title and are solely preoccupied with their own business, not with the problems that interest us, nor with the protection of our nationals resident in foreign countries. After the war, we shall have completely to transform these categories and in practice give up the system of consuls who have not made the consular service their career. Even if it costs more, we must follow the example of the English and send abroad diplomatic missions composed of men of genuine worth and paid accordingly. The result will be worth it. In the country to which he sent, the diplomat's task consists in suitably representing German interests. Furthermore, he must exactly inform his government, with the help of circumstantial reports, on all advisable measures. If our missions abroad fulfilled their duty, it would enable us considerably to lighten the services of the central administration. Fewer people at the Wilhelmstrasse and their activities would be more effective. Passing to another idea, the Fuhrer speculated whether conferring honorific distinctions on foreigners brought good results. Ambassador Huell replied that, subject to certain reservations, it did so. The Fuhrer continued, "I've often thought about that problem. Instead of offering gold cigarette cases, as we've done hitherto, it is in our interest to offer decorations. These latter, unless they're decorated with diamonds, represent an expenditure from 2 marks 50 to 25 marks, whereas a gold case costs us about 70 marks. Seeing the success we have with the award of decorations, there's no need to hesitate. The fact is that just as men are on the lookout for titles, so they run after decorations. To tell the truth, I don't much like that sort of traffic. I cannot see myself proclaiming that for 100,000 marks one becomes a vice consul, for 500,000 a consul, and for 1,000,000 a consul general. Yet that's how Imperial Germany obtained supplementary resources for herself. She was especially given to turning the title of Kammerzienrat, trade counselor, into cash. It's proper to act cautiously in this matter. Otherwise, titles and decorations lose their value. I think that old Fritz would give the Prussian State Council a piece of his mind, that miserable attempt at resurrection, if he were able to see that assembly of do-nothings at work." So, that's that first section. Carolyn, who do you think he's talking about old Fritz?
Frederick the Great.
Okay, and I think that was mine, too, because of the Prussian State Council. But, and he makes some important points right there. And to have you got to have high quality people with the nation's interest at hand rather than politicians with honorific titles representing your nation.
Well, not even just politicians. He's got talking about people who are serving for a little money, actually. For the honor of it, but he wants it to be more professional. He wants to pay the money the way the English do and get people that know, you know, are really capable and are working hard for you, not, you know, enjoying themselves.
That's right. He said, you know, the result will be worth it, and that's exactly right.
Yeah, so I guess that's been a kind of a way of doing things. That was kind of a way that they had of doing things in Germany. You know, your patriotism and so on, but often it was a matter of, you know, your ego more than your patriotism and so on. But I thought it was interesting in the very first paragraph that he mentioned the protection of our nationals resident in foreign countries. And I just, I wonder what are considered the nationals? Or does that mean people actually living who have become citizens of foreign countries, or does that mean no, they wouldn't? It would be nationals, German citizens resident in foreign countries.
German, you know, people residing in other countries.
Yeah, and that they don't do a good enough job of looking after these people and paying attention to what they're doing. I mean, they could even be useful. Other countries do that. They could be useful to the Wilhelmstrasse, which is the diplomatic, home of the, that the foreign office? So the foreign ministry is located there. And, they don't make use of enough things. He said this before, and obviously he's right, that the Germans fall down in all this, shrewd wrangling and stuff, or, you know, using every possible method to get information and learn what's going on. Well, he gets on the subject every so often. He's constantly working on it, isn't he? I mean, it's the focus of his attention. All right.
Okay. 7th of April, 1942, at dinner. The great riots of 1918 and 19, a clique of evildoers, our duty to German idealists, what the clergy cost the German state, how to economize on the church budget, put difficulties in the way of recruitment of clergy, the Reichsbishop, Pastor Niemöller, petty intriguers. Now, before I start this text, I just want to make mention, Carolyn, I read this text, 30, 35 years ago, called The Kings Depart. And it was about after Germany had been defeated in 1918, and the victorious powers were like a bunch of vultures there and started trying to set up this and wound up setting up this Weimar Republic. And people have not been taught or made aware of that the Germany at that time was torn internally by Bolshevik revolution. And so that's what he means here when he says the revolution of 1919, and it says the great riots of 1918 and 19. These were Bolshevik-inspired revolts against different cities in Germany, and they were extremely threatening to the existence of Germany itself. And had it not been for the returning soldiers that stepped in and offered their help to the local police, Germany might have indeed succumbed to communism at that time. So when we start off here, when Hitler says, when one attentively studies the revolution of 1918 and 19, one discovers that it was in no way the manifestation of a great idea. It was a vast riot, inspired above all by a scum that had only recently left the prisons and penitentiaries. Read the reports on the spread of the revolution in Cologne, Hamburg, or any other town, and you'll realize that this so-called popular rising was characterized above all by lootings and extortions. One can therefore feel only scorn for the cowards who fled before that gang. If the slightest attempt at a riot were to break out at this moment anywhere in the whole Reich, I'd take immediate measures against it. Here's what I'd do. A. On the same day, all the leaders of the opposition, including the leaders of the Catholic Party, would be arrested and executed. B. All the occupants of the concentration camps would be shot within 3 days. C. All the criminals on our lists, and it would make little difference whether they were in prison or at liberty, would be shot within the same period. The extermination of these few hundreds or thousands of men would make other measures superfluous, for the riot would be aborted for lack of ringleaders and accomplices. As for the justification of these summary executions, I've only to think of the German idealists who are risking their lives in front of the enemy or showing their devotion in a war factory, whatever their job may be, and employing all their efforts for the victory of the fatherland. It's a real scandal that we must give the German churches such extraordinarily high...
Let's talk about this part, because this is other is totally different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. He changed it.
Yeah. This is kind of interesting here that at first when I read that, I think, well, he's going to shoot everybody, kill everybody in concentration camps, which they had then for criminals and so on. And he's going to take all the criminals and shoot them too that are in prisons and so on, or even criminals they know that are at liberty. I thought, wow, that's pretty drastic. And also because he says if there's a riot anywhere in the whole Reich. So he's not saying if the whole Reich rose up and was in tumult, but if there was just, you know, in one place there was a big riot. So, but then he says, he justifies that by thinking about, again, they're at war. They're a country at war. And they're not at just any old war. They're at war for their life and their existence by this point. And so now they're, you know, he's thinking about the soldiers on the front and all the people who are working and supporting this. And then he says this is only a few hundreds or thousands, which to him, is, you know, putting it in this perspective, is not that many, and that would take care of the whole thing. But an awful lot of people would disagree with that and think that's pretty bad.
I if you consider that when that happened in 1918 and 19, Germany really, as the German Free Corps, the soldiers really didn't think they had been beaten on the battlefield, but they'd been betrayed at home. And that was by strikes called against munitions factories and other industries to damage the war effort. And then when the war was over, in swooped the vultures, and then the agitators like Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, Jewish Bolshevik agitators stirring up the working people against any manner of authority, and the soldier seeing all of that happen and feels kind of helpless and is furious because a lot of these people got away with murder at that time, killing officials. And so I can imagine, you know, like I said, it was members of the Free Corps that came home and that maybe got a hold of some weapons that they weren't supposed to have, some rifles and whatever, and they helped put a stop to this communist uprising, or Germany would have been lost to communism. And that sticks in the mind of these returning soldiers, and Hitler saw what happened to his country as a result of that, and so you're darn right, he's saying, hey, if any of that stuff came up today, there wouldn't be any messing around. They'd be shot down like the dogs they are. And,
well, putting it in the perspective, which he did right in the beginning of 1919, so putting it in that perspective, he said in order to ward off anything like that, he would just go after those kind of people, those kind of criminal type people, and political enemies who were also in concentration camps. So he just get rid of them all, and he thinks that's a better way to do it than to put other people's innocent people, good people's lives at risk, and so on.
True, and he's quite right in saying that it would immediately stop it too. So
Well, that's what you can do when you're the man in charge and you're not dealing with a democracy and you have parliament and they're going to impeach you or something.
And you have dedicated followers, too.
Yeah, right.
Continuing on, he says, it's a real scandal that we must give the German churches such extraordinarily high subsidies. It isn't like that anywhere else, even in the most fundamentally Catholic countries, with the exception of Spain. Unless I'm mistaken, our churches are still, at present, receiving 900 million marks a year. Now, the priest's chief activity consists in undermining National Socialist policy. The habit of exploiting the state goes back a long way. In periods of national tension, the Catholic Church always tried to occupy positions of temporal power and always at the expense of the German community. The difficulties of our emperors never provided the priests with a chance to prove their German feelings. On the contrary, it's a tradition amongst them to profit by every circumstance to indulge in their egoistic activities. Thus, one can never regret too much that such a powerful personality as Luther found only feeble successors. Otherwise, it would never have been possible in Germany to restore the Catholic Church on a sufficiently solid foundation to enable it to last until the present. Instead of squandering all these millions on the church, I wonder seriously whether we wouldn't be doing better to devote the greater part of the money to building farms for our soldier peasants. Himmler has told me that each of these farms works out approximately 23,000 marks, including the necessary fittings. Thus, there are more than 3,000 farms that we could offer every year, clear of all debt, to those of our soldiers who wished, after 12 years' service, to devote themselves to agriculture. It would be necessary, of course, to urge these men not to marry anyone but country girls. It would be necessary, too, to send them off during their 12th year of service to a school of agriculture in the region where they're about to settle so as to give them a suitable training. It will be essential in the service of this project to create a large number of these schools. In view of the variety of working conditions in the future Reich, these schools, in order to be really useful, will have to take account for the peculiarities of the region in which they'll be installed. On reflection, it seems to be that an annual grant of $50 million should be enough for the Catholic Church. It would be paid directly to the princes of the Church, who would be responsible for the sharing out. Thus, we could have the official guarantee, since it would be a church matter, of a just distribution of the money. These $50 million would certainly bring us in more than the $900 million now squandered every year. You can bet anything, if one relies on historical precedents, that the princes of the church would lick my boots for the value of the money, the more so if they could do what they liked with it. Therefore, if it's possible to buy the high dignitaries of the church with money, let's do it. And if one of them wanted to enjoy his life and for this purpose put his hand into the till, for the love of heaven, let him be left in peace. The ones we have to fear are the ascetics with rings under their eyes and the fanatics. After this war, I'll take the necessary steps to make the recruiting of priests extraordinarily difficult. In particular, I'll no longer allow children from the age of 10 and upwards to devote their lives to the church when they've absolutely no notion what they're undertaking in accepting celibacy, for example. Only the man who has passed his 24th year and has finished his labor service and his military service will be able to embrace an ecclesiastical career. At that age, then, if anyone is ready to vow himself to celibacy, well, let him become a priest with God's help. In parenthesis, that reminds me that some idiots made me the fatuous proposal that chiefs of the party should be celibate. While I'm on the subject, it's interesting to know how they've hitherto succeeded in filling the convents and monasteries. With the women, it's generally reasons of a sentimental nature that constitute the chief motive. With the men, on the other hand, it's usually not either the feelings or the reason that play a decisive part, but more earthy motives, such as material distress, for example. In the course of the lawsuits brought against the monasteries, it was discovered that in numerous cases, poverty had driven the unemployed to turn into monks. The men who tried to recover their liberty were caught by the priests and fetched back. Thus, one must rejoice that the closing of the monasteries enables us to restore to the life of society many men who are capable of rendering services to the community and wishful to work. This measure does not entail great difficulties. The fact is, the monasteries are generally corporations and consequently can be dissolved by means of private agreements made with the prior. Let the prior receive a monthly payment of 500 marks and his direct collaborators allowances of from 100 to 200 marks, and most of them will be quite ready to renounce their cloistered lives. In the old days, nearly 1,000 monasteries and convents were closed up in this fashion in Austria. It is a pity that in its conflict with the Catholic Church, the Evangelical Church cannot be regarded as an adversary of any stature. This fact is expressed even in material details, and it was a thing that struck me during a diplomatic reception. In their magnificent vestments, the nuncio and the bishop who accompanied him had so much style that one couldn't have claimed the Catholic Church wasn't worthily represented. Opposite them, the representatives of the Evangelical Church wore starch collars of doubtful cleanliness and greasy frock coats. Their attire was so out of place in that setting that I proposed to them that I should put suitable garments at their disposal for the next diplomatic reception. These representatives of the Evangelical Church are such petite bourgeois that they tried to discredit the Protestant Bishop of the Reich in my eyes by reporting to me that he had spent 1,400 marks on the purchase of new suites for a bedroom and a waiting room. I retorted to the gentleman that if they had asked me for a subsidy of 30,000 marks for this bishop in his capacity of Pope of the Evangelical Church, I would at once have it granted by the state, but that in addressing themselves to me as they had done, they had pronounced their own condemnation. Men of that sort have not the stature that would enable the Evangelical Church to match itself effectively against the Catholic Church. The limit of it is that these people aren't even honest. For example, at the moment when the struggle about the dismissal of the Bishop of the Reich had been joined, Marshal Goring was able to record a telephone call from Pastor Niemöller to somebody else. Niemöller, referring to a conversation with Hindenburg, was boasting as follows: "We gave the old man an extreme unction, and we pulled his leg so hard that he's ready definitely to sack that whoremaster of a bishop." That same day, Niemöller was pleading this case in front of me in the most unctuous style, interspersed with biblical quotations, to persuade me to take action against the Bishop of the Reich. I thereupon asked Goring to read out the monitoring note of the telephone conversation. If you'd seen the fright of Niemöller and the delegates of that Evangelical Church, they literally collapsed to the point of becoming dumb and invisible. Sometime later, I told Hindenburg of the incident. He dismissed the whole affair, merely remarking, "The fact is, the most insignificant of these intriguers seems to take himself for a pope." So.
Oh, well, you know, the bishop, the Reich bishop, which is of the Protestant Church, was yes. Mueller, I can't think of his first name now. But anyway, Bishop Mueller, and he was sympathetic, to say the least, with the German church idea. And he was always, you know, somebody that Hitler approved of, and therefore was happy that he was the Protestant bishop in Germany. And so here, this is who they're talking about here. He was really on the side of the National Socialists. You know, he was willing to be, and he used to give the salute and everything. Of course, even some of the Catholics did that on special occasions to show respect for the state, you know, the state government. All right. Well, that's interesting. And see, and then Niemöller was against the German church. in the beginning, he was for it. In the beginning, he was a pretty good National Socialist, but he changed after Hitler was in power for a while, and he decided he didn't like things that were going on. And he and some others, they just had to go against it, and so then he was looked like he was intriguing against Mueller, the bishop. Maybe he thought he yes. could become bishop himself.
Yeah, that to me, that was a tip-off on the guy that they have... The establishment has made a real hero out of, and but it revealed this little incident here to me revealed his real character.
Okay. Is the next one the 8th of April?
That is correct. 8th of April, 1942, midday.
Okay. Well, I've got some timeline things for the 8th. Three of
Good.
Them.
Okay.
The first one, heavy RAF bombing of Hamburg. So this was when it, the first time it happened, when they attacked Hamburg on April 8th. And I didn't check back to see if this was the big worst one that's so destructive, but it says heavy. You know, this is in Wikipedia.
Yes.
They don't want to make it sound too bad. And then the other thing is the American forces are strained for one last offensive on Bataan. That's in the Pacific there. And then
yes.
more with the withdrawal of His Majesty's ship Penelope from Malta, Force K in Malta comes to a close. Well, we've been wondering about Malta. Well, I have been. Anyway, Force K, I looked up, and it was the designation for three British Royal Navy task forces during the Second World War. The first Force K operated from West Africa in 1939, and the second and third Force Ks operated from Malta in 1941 to 1943. I don't know what that means. Did they give up on Malta or what? Are they?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All
yeah.
right. But anyway, this bombing of Hamburg, I mean, that would that got the leadership pretty upset. That got
yes.
Hitler pretty upset, but I don't
Very
know that
so.
he's not saying anything about it. But
yeah,
this is midday.
Yeah. And but you know that he this infuriated him because in his mind the war should be confined to the opposing military forces, and this blatant attack on civilians that the British initiated, you know, and his response was to let the British government know, you know, what the hell are you doing? You realize you're inviting retaliation. And back off and stop it. And then they kept hitting them with more raids. And when Germany retaliated, then papers all over the United States screamed about the German bombing, the Blitz of London, and all this garbage.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's just how the lies were perpetuated. So, anyway, 8th of April, 1942, midday. Cowardice of the middle classes. The Nazi Party wins over the workers. Nuremberg, the citadel of Marxism. German workers and their Jewish masters. Since the beginning of my political activity, I've made it a rule not to curry favor with the bourgeoisie. The political attitude of that class is marked by the sign of cowardice. It concerns itself exclusively with order and tranquility, and we know in what sense to understand that. I aimed instead to awaken the enthusiasm of the working class world for my ideas. The first years of my struggle were therefore concentrated on the object, win over the worker to the National Socialist Party. Here's how I set about it. 1. I followed the example of the Marxist parties by putting up posters in the most striking red. 2. I used propaganda trucks that were literally carpeted with posters of a flaming red, equipped with equally red flags and occupied by thundering loudspeakers. 3. I saw to it that all the initiates of the movement came to meetings without stiff collars and without ties, adopting the free and easy style so as to get the workers into their confidence. 4. As for the bourgeois elements who, without being real fanatics, wanted to join the ranks of the National Socialist Party, I did everything to put them off, resorting to bald-out propaganda, disheveled clothes, etc. My object was to rid myself right from the beginning of the revolutionaries in rabbit's pelts. 5. I ordered our protective service to treat our opponents roughly and chuck them out of our meetings with so little mildness that the enemy press, which otherwise would have ignored our gatherings, used to make much of the blows and wounds they give rise to and thus called attention to them. 6. I sent a few of our own people to take a course in public speaking in the schools organized by the other parties. Thanks to this, we obtained a good insight into the arguments which would be used by those sent to heckle at our meetings, and we were thus in a position to silence them the moment they opened their mouths. I dealt with the women from the Marxist camp who took part in the discussions by making them look ridiculous by drawing attention either to the holes in their stockings or to the fact that their children were filthy. To convince women by reasoned argument is always impossible. To have had them roughly handled by the ushers of the meeting would have aroused public indignation, and so our best plan was to have recourse to ridicule, and this produced excellent results. 7. At all my meetings, I always spoke extempore. I had, however, a number of party members in the audience with orders to interrupt along lines carefully prepared to give the impression of a spontaneous expression of public opinion, and these interruptions greatly strengthened the force of my own arguments. 8. If the police intervened, women of our party were given the task of drawing their attention either to opponents or to completely unknown people who happened to find themselves near the entrance to the hall. In cases like this, the police invariably go about their job quite blindly, like a pack of hounds, and we found that this method was most efficacious, both for ridding ourselves of undesirable elements of the audience and for getting rid of the police themselves. 9. I disorganized the meetings of other parties by sending members of our party in the guise of ushers to maintain order, but in reality, with instructions to riot and break up the meeting. By judicious use of all the above methods, I succeeded in winning the support of such large numbers of the better elements of the working classes that, in the last elections that took place before our assumption of power, I was able to organize no fewer than 180,000 party meetings. Julius Streicher rendered particularly valuable service in our struggle to gain the support of the working classes. And now it is he whom we must thank for the capture of Nuremberg, that one-time stronghold of Marxism. The population of that city, insofar as they were interested in any way in politics, and with the exception of the Jewish colony, was made up of working men who were members either of the Socialist Party or of the Communist Party. By his unrelenting attacks on the Jews, Streicher succeeded in alienating the workmen from their Jewish masters. Even so, the workers of Nuremberg, engaged for the most part in the metal trades, were by no means an unintelligent lot, and they were most stubborn adherents of Marxism. Streicher's success, then, is all the more meritorious, and he showed himself to be a master of tactics in the handling of a meeting. Not only did he annihilate the shop stewards with a torrent of ridicule, but he deprived them of any means of retaliation and made use of their discomfiture as an additional weapon with which to convince the workers. Now that, I really, really like that section, Carolyn, where he lists these 9 steps of how he got the party going and stole members from the other parties who came over to his. And all in all, as I read those step by step and then came to that number 9 where he said he disorganized the meetings of the other parties by sending his party members as disguised as ushers to maintain order, but in reality with intentions to riot and break up their meetings. In other words, what Hitler did was fight the Bolsheviks with Bolshevik methods. I mean, this is how the communists, when the National Socialists first started their meetings, these thugs, red thugs, would come in and get in positions around the audience and pretend to be listening and sympathetic, and then at the given moment, they would start fights and beat up people and things like this and disrupt the meetings. And so Hitler was very quick in addressing that and throwing it back on them. And,
Go ahead.
Yeah, for his party to even get off the ground and have a chance of survival, that's the tactics exactly that he had to adopt.
Yeah, and you know, you could think that these are things that we could do. I mean, these are things that we could do, but I was thinking that we don't have public meetings, you see. And I was thinking, well,
True. What
happened between the time of all these public meetings so long ago now, really, and Internet? These, you know, and then it came to me, well, the television came in between, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was radio, but that worked pretty good. But then television took the place of people going out to public meetings and so on, and people stayed home and watched everything on television. And after all those years of television, now we have the Internet, and people really don't intend to go out and do anything. So you'd have to adapt, perhaps, adapt these things to Internet, because we don't have control. We don't have any space on television. So that's control. The only thing we have is Internet. But we still could have, and sometimes they try to have public meetings, and they're closed down. Some of these groups do.
That's right.
So it's we live. They were much more open politically back in that day than it is now.
Well, that's true. And you know,
all these parties.
A bunch of parties: the Catholic Center Party, the Socialist, Democratic Socialist, everything. You know, Communist, whatever. But. You know, and all of those reasons you mentioned there that are different today and would make it much more difficult, to me, probably the greatest, I think that it is a lack of racial unity. And I think it's the very fact of the integration of our society, the immigration of racial elements that are not similar to the ones that really founded and built the country. And so you have communities now, and if you try to call a meeting, you don't have the racial similarity that he had back there with his party, with the people. You're going to have various races there, man, instead of ours. It's going to be, what's in it for me? How about my people? And so this is a factor mitigating against powerful public meetings, you know, with the same purpose. And that's exactly why the enemy, they recognized that many decades ago, and that's why they thought one way we can stop any racial awareness and resistance of what we're trying to do here is to blow away that racial unity through admixture. And so, I mean, and to me, that's probably the major factor that would keep us from getting off the ground.
Yeah.
Economic and military errors we must not repeat. The example of the American motor industry, mass production and limited number of models, a unique engine cooled by air, our debt of gratitude to Dino Alfieri, cut out the word if. Criteria when judging a politician, the Italian debacle in Albania, how to restore order in an army in flight. This war, like the First World War, has led to a very large measure of standardization in our technical production, but we must not repeat the mistakes we made at the end of 1918. We must make sure that our wartime achievements and experiences, economic as well as military, are not lost sight of in the days of peace ahead. In the economic field, we can learn much from the United States. The motor industry of the United States, by standardization of types and mass production, has reduced the cost of a motor car to such an extent that every workman over there can afford to keep and run a car. Our own procedure has been exactly the reverse. We are constantly bringing out new models and modifying and improving existing ones. The result is that we have to produce an immense number and variety of spare parts, for the parts of a different model of the same make of car are never interchangeable. Nothing like this occurs in America. After the war, we must, for military reasons, limit the German motor industry to the production of a dozen models, and the primary objective of the industry would be the simplification of the engine. Higher power must be achieved by increasing the number of standard cylinders rather than by the introduction of a variety of new cylinders. The dashboard, too, must be simplified. But the most important task will be the design of one single engine which can be used just as well for a field kitchen as for an ambulance, a reconnaissance car, road haulage, or a heavy artillery tractor. The 28 horsepower engine of the Volkswagen should be able to meet all these military requirements. This war has proved that great speeds are of no particular military use, and we must get away from this craze for performance. Provided that the military vehicles mentioned above can attain a speed of between 10 and 20 kilometers an hour, they will be perfectly adequate. The ideal standard engine, which I envisage, must possess two characteristics. A, it must be air-cooled, and B, it must be easy and swift to dismantle and change. This latter characteristic is particularly important because, as this war has shown, it is more difficult to get spare parts than to get a complete engine unit. Obviously, too, there must be a great measure of standardization and simplification in the manufacture of the engine envisaged. In reply to a remark by Ambassador Huell that doubts were being voiced in Berlin about the abilities of the Italian ambassador, Signor Alfieri, the Führer said, "The exceptional services rendered by Alfieri to the cause of German-Italian friendship far outweigh any little weaknesses he may now show. I shall never forget that at the time of the Austrian National Socialist coup d'etat in 1934, which led Mussolini to make the one political mistake of his life, Alfieri was among those who came out on the side of Germany. Great credit is due to that small band of men who put Mussolini on his guard against the intrigues and false friendship of the French, and thus saved him from further grave political errors. In this, Alfieri did a great service, not only to his own country, but also to Germany. The unarmed Germany of the time would have emerged from a struggle against the combined forces of France, Italy, and Great Britain in a state of ruin and desolation, comparable only to the situation at the end of the 30 Years' War. The criteria by which a politician should be judged are, firstly, the positive virtues he possesses, and secondly, the actual services he has rendered to his country. In politics, facts alone are of value, and any juggling with possible hypotheses is quite futile. It is, for example, perfectly true, but of no importance, to say that had the Romans been defeated by the Huns on the Catalonian fields, the growth of Western culture would have been impossible, and the civilization of the time would have been destroyed, as indeed our own civilization today will be destroyed if the Soviets are victorious in this war. In politics, the use of that little word if must be avoided. Where should we be today if the Czechs had a little imagination, or if the Poles had been realists and had gone about their affairs with a little more honesty? It is precisely the fact that the Pole is a dreamer and the Czech is an out-and-out realist which has enabled us swiftly and successfully to establish the new order in the territories formerly known as Czechoslovakia and Poland. It is equally impossible to imagine what might have happened if the Italian front had not been stabilized in Albania, thanks to Mussolini. The whole of the Balkans would have been set alight at a moment when our advance toward the southeast was still in its early stages. The most serious aspect of the situation was the fact that we could place no confidence in Russian protestations of friendship. It is even quite probable that we should never have received permission from the King of Bulgaria for the entry into his country of German commandos in disguise, charged with the mission of preparing for the entry of our troops. In actual fact, Boris is by temperament a fox rather than a wolf, and would have exposed himself to so great a danger only with the utmost reluctance. The fox, as we all know, prefers to pursue a course which will allow him, if danger threatens, to eliminate all trace of his passing. At the time of the Italian difficulties on the Albanian front, I pondered for some time over the best thing to do if an army started to retreat without orders and could not be brought to make a stand. And the conclusion I reached was that summary executions by shooting would be the only remedy. But it is not the little infantryman who should be shot, the poor, wretched little devil who bears the brunt of war, the pangs of hunger, and the plague of fleas. The man to shoot is the commander of the unit in retreat, regardless of who he may be.
Wow.
So,
what do you think of that?
There's some more very decisive stuff. Like a little bit ago, we were discussing if a riot revolution broke out anywhere in the right, that, you know, hey, shoot them down, and that includes this, that, and the other. That's just more, there's no gray area here. It has to be this one way. And, I thought one of the interesting things here was early in this section here, kind of where he says the National Socialist coup d'etat in 1934, which led Mussolini to make the one political mistake of his life. And I tried to look in different spots to try to find something about that in 1934, and the only thing I could come up with, Carolyn, was that he trusted France. And the words that France was, you know, was pronouncing at that time, and their stance on this emergence of national socialism and growth and things like this, and he kind of believed a lot of the things.
Was Mussolini at that time? Are you saying he was he wasn't sold on Hitler's national socialism? He was still holding on.
I think he was sold, but. He trusted the French in some of the things that they were saying. And
what were they saying?
And they were intriguing, you know, like plotting to somewhere down the road trip up the National Socialist expansionist movement, if you will call it that, by coming out now in, well, for lack of a better word, in disguise of their true motives. And, you know, and saying, yeah, you know, this Hitler looks like he might be a good thing for the German people and whatever, but we're watching him here with, you know, guarded outlook.
Yeah, he wants to take over too much. Well, I think that at that time, Mussolini was a little bit...
leery.
And that's why in 1939 he was trying to work out these conferences and so on. To prevent the problems with Poland and all of that, yeah, and he was very serious about that. I thought it was interesting that Hitler brought that up about Mussolini, and then he was commending this Alfieri, who was very strong in favor of the Germans, and he helped convince Mussolini. And, you know, I think that this was back a ways, and now... Hitler's, it started out with this Huell saying that there were some doubts being voiced about this
about
Italian
Alfieri.
Ambassador. Yeah, but Hitler, I say, you know, Hitler never forgets a good deed, does he? And he's
That's
really
right.
loyal. And once he got a good opinion of this guy and he thought he had done something that was really important for him and his party in Germany, then he wasn't going to hold anything against him. After that, he was going to stand up for him. And he did the same with Goring, who did so much for the party in the beginning, and you know, he was so important
with
building
well.
It up. And, yeah, and he just wasn't going to – and sometimes, though, he stuck out with people too long, and I think he was almost maybe too loyal to be a perfectly smart and intelligent leader, you know.
Yeah,
that sometimes things like that, got in the way, and you know, he wasn't cold enough to just disregard
his
all
loyalty
his
was certainly noble and admirable, but it sometimes reached the maybe naive stage, or
well, I don't think it was naive.
Maybe a little impractical.
he just couldn't quit being loyal. He just couldn't turn against this person, and it wouldn't even be turning against them, but, you know, it would be not supporting them, and he just couldn't seem to do it.
Right.
With a few people. But sometimes he can be very cold, but depend on what his feelings were about the people.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
You know, and it's amazing that throughout this book so far, we've seen repeated examples of that, you know, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
His loyalty to people that, you know, if someone was criticizing that person, he would fly to their defense and say, hey, you know, he may be weak right now, but by golly, if it hadn't have been for this person, our party would have never got off the ground. If this person hadn't have donated what they did or stepped forward when they did, so, you know, take it easy on the guy. So, and there's been numerous examples of that so far in this book.
Right. And then when I've got bold in here at the end of the next paragraph, I think it is, he says, our own civilization today will be destroyed if the Soviets
yes.
are victorious in this war. And that's a strong
yes.
statement. And he was believing it. He thought they were fighting for even Western civilization, you know, because he thought the
sure.
Soviets was so strong. And their intention was to take over all of Europe, and they could do it if they could get past Germany, he thought.
That's right.
But I think this is why, because he felt this way, this is why he believed that Germany was destined to win. I said something on my Monday show that someone had said that, Himmler had said that in his Posen speech, his October 4th Posen speech, and that we were destined, that we would hold off this new Soviet attack in 1943, it was, because we had to, and if we have to, we will. And it was like, and then he said something about we're destined to win this war, it's our destiny. And I thought he got that from Hitler, because Hitler talked like that and thought like that, that because of what was at stake was so great, and they were so on the right side, that they were
mm-hmm.
destined to win, as though Providence had a plan or something, you know.
Yes. Very good point.
And would come through. I don't see that as any kind of pie in the sky or occultism or anything like that. It was just
right.
his sense of justice and the way things turned out. And he would remind himself of people like Frederick the Great and others who won, but then he also realized what happened to Napoleon in Russia. So
this next section, thoroughly enjoyable to me, too.
Right.
9th of April, 1942, at dinner. The God of the Christians protects the Japanese pagans, Japanese religion, and the cult of hero worship, the unhealthy character of Christianity, superstition, brutality of the Catholic Church, the maintenance of morale without the aid of the Church. It is very curious that devout Christians like the British and the Americans should, despite their constant and fervent prayers, receive such a series of hidings from the pagan Japanese. It rather looks as if the real God takes no notice of the prayers offered day and night by the British and the Americans, but reserves his mercies for the heroes of Japan. It is not surprising that this should be so, for the religion of the Japanese is above all a cult of heroism, and its heroes are those who do not hesitate to sacrifice their lives for the glory and safety of their country. The Christians, on the other hand, prefer to honor the saints, that is to say, a man who succeeds in standing on one leg for years at one time, or one who prefers to lie on a bed of thorns rather than to respond to the smiles of inviting maidens. There's something very unhealthy about Christianity. Another peculiarity of the Christian faith, as it is taught by the Catholic Church, is that it is a school of pessimism rather than optimism. The Japanese religion, on the contrary, rouses men to enthusiasm by the promise it holds of the rewards in the hereafter, while the unfortunate Christian has no prospect before him but the torments of hell. Such pessimism has a marked effect. Even a child of 3 can be made to acquire a terror of mind which will remain with him for the whole of his life. We all know many grown-up people who are nervous in the dark simply because they had been told in their childhood that a bogeyman, a robber, or the like lurked in the shadows. It is no less difficult to eradicate these childish inhibitions than it is to free the human soul of that haunting terror of hell, which the Catholic Church impresses on it with such vigor during its most tender years. A man possessed of a minimal intelligence who takes the trouble to ponder over these questions has no difficulty in realizing how nonsensical these doctrines of the Church are. For how, he must ask himself, can a man possibly put on a spit, be roasted and tortured in 100 other ways when, in the nature of things, his body has no part in the resurrection? And what nonsense it is to aspire to a heaven to which, according to the Church's own teaching, only those have entry who have made a complete failure of life on earth. It won't be much fun, surely, to have to meet again there all whose stupidity, in spite of the biblical tag, blessed are the humble of heart, has already infuriated one beyond endurance on this earth. Imagine, too, how tremendously attractive a heaven will be to a man which contains only women of indifferent appearance and faded intellect. Only those, we are told, with the minimum of sin shall enter through the gates of heaven. Now, in spite of the fact that the burden of sin must inevitably grow heavier with each successive year, I have yet to meet a priest anxious to leave this life as quickly and therefore with as light a burden as possible. But I could name many a cardinal of 60 and over who clings most tenaciously to life on this sinful earth. When one examines the Catholic religion closely, one cannot fail to realize that it is an almost incredibly cunning mixture of hypocrisy and business acumen, which trades with consummate skill on the deeply ingrained affection of mankind for the beliefs and superstitions he holds. It is inconceivable that an educated priest should really believe all the nonsense that the Church pours out. A proof there, to my mind, is the fact that the priests themselves always try to confuse the issue on the subject of the swindle of dispensations and avoid, whenever possible, any discussion of the subject. In spite of these obvious faults and weaknesses, there are nevertheless a large number of intelligent people who preserve their faith in the Church. They believe that man requires some species of brake, B-R-A-K-E, on his activities, and that in spite of its many shortcomings, the Church represents the best deterrent that at present exists. The pity is that people who reason in this manner appear to forget that the Church does not strive to propagate its teaching by reason and gentle persuasion, but by force and threat. This is certainly not my idea of education. It is moreover obvious that had the Church followed solely the laws of love, and had she preached love alone as the means of instilling her moral precepts, she would not have survived for very long. She has therefore always remained faithful to the ancient maxim that the right hand must not know what the left hand does, and has bowed to the necessity of imposing her moral principles by means of the utmost brutality, not hesitating even to burn in their thousands men and women of merit and virtue. We ourselves are today much more humane than the Church. We obey the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," by catching and executing a murderer. But the Church, when the executive power lay in her hands, crucified, quartered, and did him to death with indescribable torture. Maintenance of the nation's morale is a task which the statesman can accomplish just as well as any Church. All he has to do is to incorporate in the law of the land all the moral beliefs of the healthy elements of the people, and then to support those laws uncompromisingly with the authority of force. So that sort of thing is so loaded with good common sense and provoking, you know, thought-provoking statements, and it's I really get fascinated when I read these things that he's saying such as that back then, because, you know, to me, that's speaking out with incredible courage about such a subject. And, you know, he points out this dispensation stuff and says, boy, the Catholic doesn't want to talk about this stuff, and that that's why the right hand, showing all the goodness of the church, can't know what the left hand is doing. Don't pay any attention to that, you know, because this dispensation stuff is, I think,
back. Well, right, but he's also saying, though, that they don't really have any choice because they wouldn't succeed if they didn't do that. Isn't he saying that? He's saying that, you know, they if they want to, and he's not totally against what they've done, you know, not
by
totally.
By forcing their ideas or their beliefs on the populace rather than spread it with love, but by force, by burning people at the stake and things like this, you know, that's how they get things done. And back, like I say, when I was reading a lot of history to get a degree and all, you know, I read about Martin Luther, and one of the things that Luther found most abhorrent about the Catholic Church at that time was that selling of indulgences, as they called it, which is just like these dispensations, you know, which, let's see, dispensations, exemption from a penalty or duty, permission to be exempted from a religious observance. And what this, what it, it enabled the moneyed class to get away with the most immoral of crimes and things like this because they could buy their way out of it. And that was one of Luther's main complaints about that and what he wanted to reform. And then this brought up here with, you know, when Hitler says the swindle of dispensations, certainly not everybody's treated the same because only the rich guy can pay for those dispensations. The whole thing was hypocrisy. And I like him, his, you know, for the courage of labeling this stuff for actually what it is.
But a lot of people had been talking that way for a long time, like Luther. And Dietrich Eckart thought that way and influenced Hitler quite a bit. So Hitler is just going along with it. He's seeing the wisdom, the truth of it. So
sure.
I like very much where he says, you have to meet all these stupid people in heaven. And he says, you know, that you that have already infuriated one beyond endurance on this earth. I just love his choice of words. Of course, he said it in German, but still, he had to have said it that way. Yeah, you know, you're so infuriated by these people, and then you're going to go and spend eternity with them. That's a lot of fun.
Oh, my. Good stuff.
Yeah, it is. Well, he likes to go on with it. I don't know what brings it up. If he just brings it up himself, or we're not, you know, one thing this new fellow doesn't do, he doesn't tell us who the guests are.
Yes, that's true.
Kicker.
If they say something, he mentions it,
which is interesting. But he doesn't tell. I imagine there have been some guests here, but we don't know.
Yeah, and there may have been lead-in statements or whatever, like you say, that prompted Hitler's response in the manner that he did, too, you know, and they're not really mentioned.
And this idea that Bormann was running the whole thing, well, if he was, wouldn't he have made it the same all the way through? Wouldn't he have told Picker, well, you need to put in the, you know, when he looked over the notes, well, you need to put in the guests? Because the other guy had always been putting in the guests. But he didn't say that to this Picker. So I don't know how close attention he was paying to it, you know? Right?
Yeah.
Because I would even have said that. If I'd seen it was that it always had the guest mentioned, I would say, well, come on. You need to list here who's here as guests. And it's going to be interesting to see if when we get back to, I forgot the other man's name already, Heine or something. When we get back to him, if he starts listening to guests again.
Sure.
He keeps doing it his same way. Well, we'll find out when we get there. Well, okay, looks like we have time. Well, this is a short one.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
what is the date of this next?
10th
what is
of April.
Oh, okay. Well, I just happen to have the 10th timeline here. And it is On the 10th of April, the Japanese land on Cebu Island, a large middle island of the Philippines. And
yes.
Then there's one on the 12th. I don't know. I'll just say that now because I don't know if we're going to get to the 12th or not. But Japanese forces capture I'm not even going to try to say that word in Burma, a place in Burma. So it's still all about the Japanese victories.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, we've got two pretty short ones now in a row here, and then this first one says the 10th of April, 1942, foreign students at German universities. Hitler has just been studying the list of the new Bulgarian ministers. Now, quoting the Führer, there are a large number of Bulgarians who have studied engineering or taken their degrees in Germany. It would be a good policy to facilitate the taking of degrees by foreigners at our universities, and we shall make friends for life of men who spent some of their youth in this fashion. The universities of Erlangen, Gießen, and even Würzburg, which all have difficulty in keeping going, should take special pains to attract foreigners, while Heidelberg, which enjoys so great a reputation in the Anglo-Saxon world, should ensure that everything possible is done to ensure the well-being of foreign students.
Yeah, that was short, wasn't it?
Yeah, that speaks well for German education, particularly in the areas of engineering and science. So, and then the next one, April the 10th, 1942, evening. Methods of external broadcasting give the facts without comment. Propaganda destined for abroad must not in any way be based on that used for home consumption. Broadcast to Britain, for example, must contain plenty of music of the kind that is popular among Britons. In this way, when their own transmitting stations starve them of music, they will acquire the habit of listening in more and more to the concerts we broadcast for them. As regards news bulletins to Britain, we should confine ourselves to plain statements of facts without comment on their value or importance. News about British high finance, its interests in certain sections of the armament industry, in the leadership and conduct of the war, should be given without comment, but couched in such a way that the British listeners will themselves draw their own conclusions. As the old saying has it, little drops of water will gradually wear the stone away. For our own people, we must broadcast not only the facts, but also copious and precise commentaries on their importance and significance. Good propaganda must be stimulating. Our stations must therefore go on talking about the drunkard Churchill and the criminal Roosevelt on every possible occasion. So,
He's right about all that. He's right.
Oh, yeah.
Can't find any fault with that. I wonder if that's... I'm sure he was talking to Goebbels enough that that's what he was doing. So. Well, you want to say anything more about that propaganda part? I think it's interesting, pretty clear.
It's pretty clear. And I think this next one, Carolyn, will be our last one. I think we've got time to do it. Okay. 11th of April, 1942, at dinner, Rosenberg and the Myth of the 20th Century, an unorthodox book from the party point of view. It has the Catholics to thank for its success. Civilization and individual liberty. The spirit of solidarity is imposed by force. German policy in the Eastern Territories. Faults to avoid. Our attitude towards the local inhabitants. Creation of a network of communication. No arms for natives. I must insist that Rosenberg's The Myth of the 20th Century is not to be regarded as an expression of the official doctrine of the party. The moment the book appeared, I deliberately refrained from recognizing it as any such thing. In the first place, its title gives a completely false impression. There is indeed no question of confronting the conceptions of the 19th century with the so-called myth of the 20th. A National Socialist should affirm that to the myth of the 19th century, he opposes the faith and science of our times. It is interesting to note that comparatively few of the older members of the party are to be found among the readers of Rosenberg's book, and that the publishers had, in fact, great difficulty in disposing of the first edition. It was only when the book was mentioned in a pastoral letter that the sales began to go up, and the first 10,000 were sold. In short, the second edition was launched by Cardinal Fulhaber of Munich, who was maladroit enough to attack Rosenberg at a synod of bishops and to cite quotations from his book. The resultant placing of the book on the index as a work of heresy on the party's part merely gave additional fillip to its sale. And when the church had finally published all its commentaries in refutation of Rosenberg's ideas, The Myth of the 20th Century sold its 200,000th copy. It gives me considerable pleasure to realize that the book has been closely studied only by our opponents. Like most of the Gauleiters, I have myself merely glanced cursorily at it. It is, in any case, written in much too abstruse, a style in my opinion. A very large measure of individual liberty is not necessarily the sign of a high degree of civilization. On the contrary, it is the limitation of this liberty within the framework of an organization which incorporates men of the same race, which is the real pointer to the degree of civilization attained. If men were given complete liberty of action, they would immediately behave like apes. No one of them could bear his neighbor to earn more than he did himself, and the more they lived as a community, the sharper their animosities would become. Slacken the reins of authority, give more liberty to the individual, and you are driving the people along the road to decadence. The eternal mouthings about the communal spirit, which brings men together of their own free will, make me smile. In my own little homeland, when the lads of the village met in the local tavern, their social instincts rapidly degenerated under the influence of alcohol into brawling, and not infrequently finished up in a real fight with knives. It was only the arrival of the local policeman which recalled them to the realization that they were all fellow members of a human community. The idea of human solidarity was imposed on men by force, and can be maintained only by the same means. For this reason, it is unjust to condemn Charlemagne because, in what he considered to be the best interest of the German people, he built up the whole organization of the state on a basis of constraint. Stalin equally has, during these last few years, applied to the Russian people measures very similar to those of Charlemagne, because he too has taken into consideration the very low level of culture among the Russians. He realized the imperative necessity of uniting the Russian people in a completely rigid political organization. Had he not done so, he could not possibly have ensured a livelihood for the heterogeneous masses which make up the USSR, nor could he have extended to them those benefits of civilization, such as medical care, the value of which they cannot appreciate. In order to retain our domination over the people and the territories we have conquered to the east of the Reich, we must therefore meet, to the best of our ability, any and every desire for individual liberty which they may express, and by so doing deprive them of any form of state organization, and consequently keep them on as low a cultural level as possible. Our guiding principle must be that these people have but one justification for existence: to be of use to us economically. We must concentrate on extracting from these territories everything that is possible to extract. As an incentive to them to deliver their agricultural produce to us and to work in our mines and armament factories, we will open shops all over the country at which they will be able to purchase such manufactured articles as they want. If we started bothering about the well-being of each individual, we should have to set up a state organization on the lines of our own state administration, and all we should achieve would be to earn the hatred of the masses. In reality, the more primitive a people is, the more it resents as an intolerable restraint any limitation of the liberty of the individual. The other great disadvantage of an organized society is, from our point of view, that it would fuse them into a single entity and would give them a cohesive power with which they would use against us. As an administrative organization, the most we can concede to them is a form of communal administration, and that only insofar as it may be necessary for the maintenance of the labor potential, that is to say, for the maintenance of the elementary basic needs of the individual. Even these village communities must be organized in a manner which precludes any possibility of fusion with neighboring communities. For example, we must avoid having one solitary church to satisfy the religious need of large districts, and each village must be made into an independent sect, worshiping God in its own fashion. If some villages, as a result, wish to practice black magic after the fashion of Negroes or Indians, we should do nothing to hinder them. In short, our policy in the wide Russian spaces should be to encourage any and every form of dissension and schism. It will be the duty of our commissars alone to supervise and direct the economy of the captured territories, and what I have just said applies equally to every form of organization. Above all, we don't want a horde of schoolmasters to descend suddenly on these territories and force education down the throats of subject races. To teach the Russians, the Ukrainians, and the Kyrgyz is to read and write will eventually be to our own disadvantage. Education will give the more intelligent among them an opportunity to study history, to acquire an historical sense, and hence to develop political ideas which cannot but be harmful to our interests. A loudspeaker should be installed in each village to provide them with odd items of news and, above all, to afford distraction. What possible use to them would a knowledge of politics or economics be? There is also no point in broadcasting any stories of their past history. All the villagers require is music, music, and plenty of it. Cheerful music is a great incentive to hard work. Give them plenty of opportunities to dance, and the villagers will be grateful to us. The soundness of the views is proved by our experience at home during the time of the Weimar Republic. One thing which is essential to organize in the Russian territories is an efficient system of communications, which is vital both to the rational economic exploitation of the country and to the maintenance of control and order. The local inhabitants must therefore be taught our highway code, but beyond that, I really do not see the need for any further instruction. In the field of public health, there is no need whatsoever to extend to the subject races the benefits of our own knowledge. This would result only in an enormous increase in local populations, and I absolutely forbid the organization of any sort of hygiene or cleanliness crusades in these territories. Compulsory vaccination will be confined to Germans alone, and the doctors in the German colonies will be there solely for the purpose of looking after the German colonists. It is stupid to thrust happiness upon people against their wishes. Dentistry, too, should remain a closed book to them, but in all these things, prudence and common sense must be the deciding factors, and if some local inhabitant has a violent toothache and insists on seeing a dentist, well, an exception must be made in his particular case. The most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow the subject races to possess arms. History shows that all conquerors who have allowed their subject races to carry arms have prepared their own downfall by so doing. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that the supply of arms to the underdogs is a sine qua non for the overthrow of any sovereignty. So let's not have any native militia or native police. German troops alone will bear the sole responsibility for the maintenance of law and order throughout the occupied Russian territories, and a system of military strong points must be evolved to cover the entire occupied country. All Germans living in the eastern territories must remain in personal contact with these strong points. The whole must be most carefully organized to conform with the long-term policy of German colonization, and our colonizing penetration must be constantly progressive until it reaches the stage where our own colonists far outnumber the local inhabitants. So, a lot of long-range thinking there. And once again, you know, like we see in some of these statements, you know, they would be attacked as cold.
Worse than that.
Maybe even, yeah, savage and you know.
Genocidal. Genocidal,
yeah.
Ray.
Yeah, there you go. I was just going to say, Carolyn, that so much of what he says here does make sense, because when he talks about this medical care and and everything, what I think about what the white nations have done in Africa by going over there and treating diseases and trying to give all kinds of agricultural produce and all that, it seems the humane thing to do, but it's anti-nature, because in that nation, in that continent itself, nature takes care of itself, and with the first world nations rushing in with all this kind of aid to the third world nations, they've thrown everything out of whack. And as exactly what he's talking about here, the population have exploded to so many more millions than the land can sustain. So now you've got No, he's not. But what he says, he does mention that if we do this, then it's going to, he says, in the field of public health,
well, it's
going to
work against us. Yeah, absolutely.
But
Ray, people will say, white nationalists who you associate with will say that they're talking about Russians, not Africans. They're talking about Russians. They're white people. What do you say to that? Well, he thinks they're talking about Bolsheviks and lots of mixed race people in Russia. But still, it's not Africans.
Enormous increase in the local populations, which at that time the local populations overwhelmingly, and even in this country at that time, you know, the level of education and people who could read was appallingly low in actuality. And, you know, and they weren't, you know, on the same plane as the German people as far as their capabilities.
Well, I agree that these people weren't on the same plane as the German people. And I would say that this whole section here gives an answer to why Hitler was wary of arming the Slavic nationalists to fight the Soviets. Because they were all people that he didn't want. He didn't want them to have their own, he didn't
militia.
Want them to be in control. Yeah, and that's right.
Yeah, their own police force, their own militias, that's right.
Right. So they all had to be subject, and I think we have to face up to that was kind of the plan, but it wasn't going to be so bad, because he thought that for the most part, these people that he was talking about were peasants. And they were used to living like that, and he just wasn't going
That's
to change
right.
it. We'll just leave them the way they are. They'll be happy, and they'll even be better off. They'll have more than they had before.
And he doesn't talk about wiping them out. He talks about outliving them with the German colonization, you know, and the German people who colonized those vast spaces in Russia would one day outnumber the Russian people there. So it would be in a... an ongoing and long-lasting type thing. It was not a genocide or extermination.
Do you think that this was could ever have worked out? I have to wonder whether this could ever have worked out, because human nature doesn't just fit along the way these plans go, you know. And
really, you're right. There's no way of knowing that, and only time would tell. So. I could guess that, it might work, but then again, like you say, human nature being what it is, you don't know, and only a century or two centuries down the road would some proof of the pudding either say yes or no.
Well, I like the part in the beginning where he's talking about the need to use force, that people don't join together and get along together just on their own. That doesn't happen, and that they'll start fighting. They always start fighting. And this is one thing that's wrong with this white nationalist idea about every European little little country and group is going to have their own self-determination. They're going to have their own little nation. And we're all going to get along because we're white people. Well, we've been white people for a long, long, long time. We didn't get along. So that, I think, doesn't work out. And it has to be, what's that word he used for Charlemagne, but not coercion, but, you know, not that. But in any case, I don't like the word force too much, but that's the one I guess I'll have to use for this that he's using. Oh, here it is. Constraint, you know. You have to be able to have the power to pass laws, and everybody has to follow them. You know, they're not, they're just to keep order and so on. And people get used to that, and, you know, that's what needs to be done. He's admitting that, and there's a lot of these liberal dreamers who think differently, that you don't have to do that. But even libertarians think that way. But I agree with Hitler. And he thought the Germans were the only ones who could really do that. In order to keep peace and to keep the white race intact on that continent, and that included part of the Russian continent. He wasn't going to go all the way through Asia. He wanted to stop at the Urals and
keep them
all on the other side, and you could have a nice, real strong protective force there, and they wouldn't be able to get through it. Although, you know, that all made sense then. We look at today's world with all the inventions and so on. You don't know. A lot of things would have had to change and adapt and evolve, but I think they would have. So I still think it would have been good if he had been able to carry out what he was wanted to carry out. I think it would have turned out far better than a lot of people say today, which they want to say that these people would all be slaves. And, well, you know, they weren't treated well then where they were, and they hadn't been forever. You know,
that's
so
right.
It wasn't going to be worse for them, that's for sure.
That's right.
As I was saying on Monday, if you there's history is made or something like that, advancement is made by superior men with superior ideas. And I think Hitler was one of those men.
Agreed.
And, I know, one last thing I want to make. When he says that if you want to keep people disunified, then give them lots of freedoms. You know, that's what he's saying here. And that's exactly what we've got. That's exactly what the Jews, Jewish culture, whatever, does to us, gives us. So we have all kinds of freedoms to do not much of anything, but just to destroy ourselves, not to be serious. And that's what they're after. That's how they tear us apart.
Right.
Right. So, you know, that was another wise thing that he was saying and was right about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we reached that point where both of us had it figured we would make it to. So I think it's been a successful evening.
Well, I think so, too. Why don't you sign us out here, Ray, while I look for the outro music.
Okay, folks, we appreciate you joining us this evening, and we look forward to next week. We'll see you back next Thursday, October 30th, 7 o'clock, and looking forward to having you with us. Thank you and good evening.
Good night, everyone.